Take the bass line out. Uh-huh. Here go. Yeah. Let it bump, though.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another long-awaited edition of the Hardwood Knox podcast. I am Dan Favalli, and I am coming at you, as always, with Andy Bailey. How are we doing today, Andy, on this Friday, mere hours after the Houston Rockets were eliminated by the San Antonio Spurs, who were playing without locker room on-court cancer Kawhi Leonard?
Wow, what an introduction, especially for Kawhi. I'm doing good. That was insane. I was out of town for the first half of that game, and I kind of checking the score on my way home. Turned on the TV, and I think it was close to 30 by the time I turned it on, and it just blew me away. I can't imagine any other organization, maybe in any sport, that can do like that's not surprising to see that. For them to have their best player out, I understand that they're probably better without Tony Parker, but to have their starting point guard out too, and then to just put it on the Rockets in Houston the way they did, it was like the most Spursian thing possible happened last night.
There's not even the Patriots. Like, you know, like they won those, would they go 3-1 without Brady this year?
Yeah. And they were like pretty good that one year that they had, was it Matt Cassel?
Yeah. And I guess at this point we could throw the Warriors in there, but the caveat is like, if you pulled Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, and Kevin Durant from the lineup, they're still left with Stephen Curry, and the Spurs don't have those types of safety nets. LaMarcus Aldridge can be a star, and he was fantastic. He was absolutely fantastic in Game 6. But you remove Kawhi Leonard for so much of the postseason. He's been there everything on offense. And to see the biggest thing, the turning point in that series for me, was that they were able to keep Jonathan Simmons on the floor, and he wasn't hurting them offensively. He all of a sudden started making shots again.
Yeah.
He missed a few threes last night, but I think he was 8 of 12 from the field, and he was dishing out assists. And now they're probably going to lose him in restricted free agency.
Yeah, I remember earlier in the playoffs, I kind of thought, and I might have even like tweeted about it, that San Antonio just seemed so dependent on Kawhi. And I like, there wasn't a ton of talent that leaped off the roster beyond him. And I didn't think they were very dangerous for that reason. I thought they had kind of become a one-man show. And last night was about as vivid a reminder of what this organization and what this system is about. Like I was saying last night that maybe Pop's biggest strength as a coach is that he can have 15 guys on a roster engaged and ready to run the system and play their heart out. Like if they get on the floor for 2 or 3 minutes. It's incredible the way that he's cultivated depth in this team over the last few years.
And they're such big shapeshifters now. At the beginning of the playoffs, Jonathan Simmons' demeanor towards the end of the season in the playoffs, to me, didn't look great. He wasn't really in the rotation. They were going to Kyle Anderson before him. And, like, you're just wrong if you think that there's something there. Maybe he was pissed that he wasn't playing and it's a contract year. But he just comes in and, like, he hasn't deviated from the team concept and trying to get his own. He still plays within the constructs of the Spurs. And these other guys, David Lee goes from being a prominent part of the rotation to playing 8 minutes in a blowout. Dwayne Dedmon, who I honestly thought was going to be the second most important defensive player for them in the playoffs because of his ability to switch pick and rolls more than Aldridge, Lee, or Gasol, he's only playing 4 minutes in a blowout and was pulled from the starting lineup just before the postseason or at the beginning of the postseason. It's just amazing that they're able to make these changes and everyone staying engaged. So it's not like this is a set in stone pecking order that Pop is so rigid he won't tweak. He messes with it. He butchers with it. He manipulates it. And all these guys are just ready. It's phenomenal to me, and it's mind-boggling as well.
This would be interesting to... This is something I'm probably going to look up when we're done recording, just because
Maybe we should come prepared stuff more up often like this. Now before we record.
But I'm looking at their roster on Basketball Reference. They have 10 guys with a box plus minus over one. And I can't imagine there's another team in the league that has more than that.
No.
And all these guys, among that 10, the one with the fewest minutes is Davis Bertans, who's still at 808 minutes.
How many guys did they have play over 800 minutes? Was it 10?
They had 12 guys over 800 minutes.
That has to be the most in the league, too.
Yeah, that's crazy.
That's just absolutely nuts.
Yep.
Do you give them a chance against the Warriors, though?
I don't. My little brother texted me last night. And he's like, what are the Spurs chances? I think he just really wants an upset. And I said, Warriors in four.
You're probably, if it goes six, I would be mildly surprised.
Like, you think it's going to be Warriors in five?
That's what I want. My heart and the person who is, one, a fan of chaos, and two, a fan of competitive series, I just want to say seven, because the Spurs have, on multiple occasions, played the Warriors so well. But over the course of a seven-game series, when you're just playing each other one right after the other, when the Warriors are engaged, I don't think this play style stands up to theirs. And I also don't think, as the Spurs showed against the Rockets, and I guess it's okay because they ended up winning, but they weren't necessarily willing to adjust their lineup combinations and play style. They made a ton of defensive adjustments, and the fact that they were doing that from game to game and when one thing wasn't working, that was phenomenal. But it wasn't like they committed to playing Kawhi at the four and to play a little bit faster and to launch more threes. And I think to some extent, and that's the problem with the Jazz and the Spurs, is to some extent you have to be able to play a little bit of the Warriors' style. It's fine to displace them from their comfort zone, but if you fall behind by a lot, you need to be able to shoot a lot of threes to come back. And I think the Jazz are more willing to do that than the Spurs, but you also need to play a little bit faster to get yourself some extra possessions if you are playing from behind. And I don't know that the Spurs are willing to do that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the chaos fan in me actually kind of wants San Antonio to win this series, because I think it would make Golden State's offseason slightly more interesting. I also want to see...
Imagine that would
Yeah,
be fantastic.
That rematch is cool. I do want to see the Warriors-Cavs rematch, too. At this point, not having a rooting interest is kind of fun. I can just sit back and relax.
Welcome to the last decade of being a Knicks fan.
What I was also going to say is Utah, I think, did try to match Golden State style a little bit in Game 3, which was actually the game that they were most competitive in until about maybe 2 or 3 minutes into the fourth quarter, when Golden State just put their foot on the gas and ran away with it. So I agree with you that, like, for the last 2 or 3 years, I've thought the best way to try to beat them is to play polar opposite and to grind the game to a halt, muck it up a little bit. And I think Utah did a good job of that in a couple of regular season games. But I agree with what you're saying now, and Jeff Van Gundy made a point like this on Zach Lowe's podcast recently too. Like, you have to find a way to get more shots if you're playing against Golden State. And one way is to maybe play a little faster. Like you said, one of the ways that Van Gundy mentioned was you hit the offensive boards really hard. And while that's kind of scary against the Warriors, because then maybe you open yourself up to that transition attack.
Right.
But there, you have to, it's like, what do you have to lose against the Warriors? You have to try stuff over the course of the series, because if you just go in, you know, and try to play them the way you have traditionally for the last couple of years, it's probably not going to work. Now, having said that, the Spurs did beat the Warriors by over 20 points twice this season. So I don't know. Maybe they have more of a chance than I'm giving them. But to me, it just seems like Golden State's talent is going to overwhelm everybody.
Do you think that Greg Popovich has just had schemes, defensive designs, and stuff just up his sleeve all year, planning for this potential matchup, and just hasn't broken it out that we've seen? And I thought if there was, we would have seen some of it in that Rocket series, but the Spurs are just so, they're so good that they're mysterious, that I can't imagine them not having maybe some lineup combinations, or maybe they're going to do something with the Warriors' off-ball movement that we're not going to see coming, and have been planning for this and just haven't unleashed it yet because they're trying to win the element of surprise. It seems like such a basic and stupid thing to say, but if you're them,
no, I think that wouldn't surprise me, and like it also wouldn't surprise me if they didn't use it against the Rockets. I think last night holding Kawhi Leonard out was a pretty good indication that they weren't that worried about the Rockets. So having maybe a few more tricks up their sleeves for the Warriors is something that wouldn't surprise me at all. Sorry, I cut you off. Keep going.
No. That's, you finished what I was going to say. So I'm totally down with that.
The other thing about them defensively is you mentioned maybe they have something for the Warriors off-ball movement, and I think maybe more than any other team in the league, the Spurs are prepared to handle that. For the last two or three years, when you watch the Spurs play defense, it's almost hard to believe the way that they defend off the ball. It's like they know the cuts are happening and they know the screens are happening before the offensive player does, and they get themselves in the right position, like right on the catch every single time. It's crazy to me. They maybe don't jump passing lanes as much as some other teams do, but I think that's because they play sort of a safer brand of defense where they don't want to foul. They don't want to leave themselves exposed to back cuts and stuff like that. Like, they know what the play is and they just put themselves in the perfect position to defend it. It's crazy the way that they can anticipate an opposing team's actions.
I think the biggest issue for them, and this is probably what's been most impressive about them as well, so it's weird. It's a weird juxtaposition. I don't know how you get by with your dual big lineups against the Warriors. I just don't.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
So many of your bigs, most of them, Gasol, Aldridge, Lee, their most valuable stationary rim protectors. Dedmon's really the only one who can switch, and he kind of trailed off toward the end of the season. The lineup I would like to see, and I'm making adjustments for the Spurs before we've seen that they needed to make them, is DeMonte Murray at this point with Jonathan Simmons, Danny Green, Kawhi Leonard, and Dwayne Dedmon. I would just like, it seems like the switching potential in that lineup is fantastic. They should be able to carve out enough spacing. I know Murray isn't
that's the best probably their most athletic
shooter.
Five too.
Yeah, and I would just like to see, I mean, you could replace Murray with Ginobili because you have Leonard and Green who'll defend point guards, and that might work as well, but that would be something I'm interested in seeing. I just, again, are the Spurs so married to their style that they're not gonna displace themselves from it, and the goal is to make the Warriors stage these adjustments? I honestly don't know, because I would have thought.
I do want to see some Kawhi at the four too, just with any other combination.
Those lineups just were non-existent, like during the regular season.
Maybe that's one of the things that Pop is sort of saving, like you mentioned.
Maybe. And Kawhi's ankle is going to be huge in this one. I think it says that he's going to play in game one on Sunday, which is good. And it seems like they were just holding him out as a precaution, but you need him to. I mean, like,
he's got
to
be full strength.
Right.
Yeah.
This isn't a Rocket situation where, yes, you have Danny Green and Jonathan Simmons, both of whom have spent time on James Harden. So, like, those are luxuries, but, you know, let's fill that out. Okay. You put Danny Green on Steph. You put Jonathan Simmons on, I don't think you could put him on Durant because of the size difference, but you put him on Clay. Like, they're still Draymond and KD that Kawhi, one of them is someone Kawhi is going to have.
That's the crazy thing about the Warriors is you can have, like, you can have such a good defense with so many solid individual defenders, and you're almost always going to be one matchup short still.
It's so the way the assignments will shake out is Kawhi gets KD, right? And Danny Green will get Steph? Or do you think Simmons will get Steph, and then they'll try and use, like, Danny Green on Draymond?
Yeah, that's the... I would guess they probably start with that first one, with Danny Green on Curry, But yeah, I think Draymond is the matchup that, like,
defines the series.
Foils everything. Yeah. Who guards him? And that's why I think some maybe Kawhi power forward stuff might be interesting. But then who guards Durant? Like,
Green.
all the stuff that you shift around, it's like the Warriors always have one spot that they can exploit, at least.
I guess what the Spurs could do is if you put Kawhi on Draymond and then you put Danny Green on KD. You could put Jonathan Simmons on Stephen Curry. Again, he proved he could at least hang with James Harden for points. I know Harden had a cold and was awful in game six. And then, as you were just talking about with the way San Antonio's off-ball defense is, I'm not saying you would hide someone on Clay, but like Clay is probably the matchup you're least worried about because he is in constant motion, and that might be the defensive assignment you're best prepared for.
Yeah, and he hasn't – Clay hasn't been great in the playoffs. Maybe that just means he's bound to break out any moment. Yeah. But, yeah, I think they maybe have one or two guys that are willing to just sort of chase – Clay around off the ball, and you focus the really good on ball guys on other players. But it, like I've said a couple times now, like no matter how you reconfigure it, something is always going to be kind of scary to look at.
Yeah, that the starting lineup matchups are it's going to be incredible. If the Spurs keep it the same, you're going to end up with LaMarcus Aldridge on Draymond Green, which just can't happen.
Yeah, that's just asking for disaster.
And when they go small, you can't have Pau Gasol on Draymond Green or David Lee on Draymond Green.
Yeah, it's and I mean, I kind of thought the Warriors would go 12-0 up to the finals anyway. But I after seeing the way they dismantled Utah, I thought they would sweep Utah. I didn't think it would be that lopsided.
That might have been the most competitive second round series, though, even though it was a sweep.
I mean, for stretches, there was to me that series was like Utah was competitive for like 2.5 quarters of every game, but Golden State. I mean, I think in the back of their minds, they play certain teams and they know they only have to like turn it on for about a quarter and they're fine.
It's not. It seemed they beat teams with these unreal 2 to 4 minute stretches. That happened
that's
between
what it is.
One and three times a game.
Sometimes it's like, yeah, I was going to say, sometimes it's spread out over a game. Sometimes it's like a 6 minute stretch and that's all it takes. And the rest is just cruise control. But that's another crazy thing about this Warriors team. They really don't have to put together like 48 minutes of great Warriors basketball to win and to win easily. Like they can win a game easily by playing 25 minutes of Warriors basketball.
Right.
It's insane.
So what would be your pick for this series? I'm almost inclined to say Warriors in six just because I could so envision the Warriors losing game one. Like that's the one-off situation.
Yeah, just coming out loud a little bit.
Right. It's like the season opener when the Spurs just destroyed them. I could see it being a little bit like that, and then I would expect San Antonio to win at least one of its own games, like at home.
I was thinking... Like I think I said earlier, I was thinking Warriors in four, and that's what I've told a couple people. But I'm gonna switch right now. You've talked me into Warriors in five.
I'm still switch. Between five and six. I would love for this to go seven, and I want to see Warriors Cavs, but I almost would rather see Spurs Cavs because I think it would be more competitive. I honestly, the Cavs need another piece before I'd be confident that they can rival the Warriors. They just, and I know it's impossible for them to get that other piece, but they need something like another piece before. Like the Warriors have Kevin Durant. The Cavaliers almost lost to the Warriors in five games last year, and then the Warriors got Kevin Durant.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about. That was one thing I thought right after the Utah series was, like, this was arguably already the best team maybe ever assembled, and then they added a guy who's arguably the best scorer ever.
I don't even know how to describe it, but like Kevin Durant, and Jeff Van Gundy brought this up in the low post, he's the second best small forward in NBA history, right? It goes LeBron, then him.
Yeah, that was interesting to hear that too. Maybe you still say Larry Bird, but yeah, I think Kevin Durant has a very strong argument.
Yeah,
I stand by the fact that he's probably the best like pure scorer ever too.
No, there's his marriage between efficiency, volume, and the types of shots he's taking. I think LeBron, when you look at his efficiency and volume, like that's historic, and we've probably seen these big guys who take a ton of looks and their percentages are so high. But you look at the shots Kevin Durant takes, you know, the three-pointers or those tough twos, and his efficiency is always so high. His true shooting percentage is always so high. He's a perpetual 50-40-90 guy.
And you add to all that just the fact that he's 7 feet tall. Like
he's listed at 6'9", okay?
I don't care about that. He is one. I mean, he is. I used to always love seeing him stand next to Serge Ibaka when they were both on the Thunder. And from several angles, he would look taller.
There was that picture floating around with Team USA where he looked taller than DeMarcus Cousins.
Yeah, I remember that too. Just to sort of punctuate this discussion you just started about his efficiency, this is insane.
You're leaving us?
He's been in the league. Yeah, I had to count something. He's been in the league 10 seasons, and seven of them have been a true shooting percentage over 600.
My God.
This season, his true shooting percentage was 6.651. He hasn't had a true shooting percentage under 600 since 2010-11.
That's just nuts.
So from 2011-12 till now, his true shooting percentage is 635.
That's just mind-blowing.
Yeah. I mean, and they added that to a team that won 73 games.
They have two of the most efficient scorers or volume ever. Shooters in NBA history on their team. They might be the two most efficient volume shooters in NBA history.
That was another thing. Stephen Curry had, I am very confident, the greatest offensive season of all time last year.
Yeah, without question. I couldn't believe that people didn't think otherwise.
Yeah. So, okay, that's another thing you add Kevin Durant to. It's mind-blowing. And all this gets back to our original point that it's really hard to see anyone beating them. But I have said in the past, I think maybe even on this podcast, that I'm done discounting LeBron. Like, as good as that all is, statistically, like, mind-blowing the Warriors are, I still would not be shocked to see LeBron pull off another miracle.
It's fun, and it's like you just said, not having a rooting interest is just so, it's awesome because, yeah, you'd probably prefer to have a rooting interest in games that matter this much, but you can look at this, and you can appreciate almost every single potential matchup. Like, no one's beating, and we should probably get to this now, but no one's beating the Cavaliers.
That's over.
And so we're going to get Spurs-Cavs or Spurs-Warriors, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, either one of those is awesome. I'm not one of these people that thinks like inevitability of Warriors Cavs is a bad thing either. I think that was great for the league in the 80s when it was Lakers Celtics, and I think it's good for the league now too.
The only way it sucks to me, first of all, we need this matchup because you need, even if it's a blowout on the Warriors or the Cavs' part, you need this because of what happened the past 2 years.
The Warriors won and the Cavs
countered. That you need like this best of three set. So it might almost be a disappointment if we don't see it, but you can imagine if it doesn't happen this year, it'll happen again because you don't necessarily see the competitive landscape shifting so much that neither of these teams would fail to reach the finals in the next 2 years or something. But it only becomes boring if, let's say the Warriors blow them out this year, and then let's say it happens again and they blow them out again. If it becomes clear that the Cavaliers just aren't up to snuff with the Warriors, that's when it would become... Yeah.
I would agree with that.
Who do you think Cleveland's not losing, but who do you think is the bigger threat to them in the Eastern Conference Finals? The Wizards or the Celtics who are playing game six tonight?
Gosh, this series is like this series is hard for me to peg because every time I think it's kind of decided one way, there's a blowout the other way. Like 2 or 3 days ago I thought the Wizards will give the Cavs a much more competitive series, and then they get blasted by 20 or 30 points or whatever it was. I think my gut still says Washington is a tougher matchup for Cleveland. I think they have a little bit more talent at the top than the Celtics.
You're such an Al Horford hater.
Well, that name actually did pop into my mind like right before you said that. he's been unreal in the postseason. Isaiah Thomas is obviously a great offensive player. But to me, Boston is more of like a... They're like a 1 through 10 solid depth type of team where I think Washington has a little bit more firepower at the top. So maybe it's sort of a philosophical question, like what kind of team do you think is better between those two? And I think in a playoff series, it's the Washington model. When rotations are usually shortened up and you can play your best guys over 40 minutes a game. So that's without even predicting whether or not Washington will escape this series, I still somehow think that they might be a little bit tougher for Cleveland.
So as on this podcast and in many of the things I've written, I'm wrong all the time. I am honestly proud of myself for sticking with the Celtics all year as the Cavaliers' biggest threat. A lot of people thought they were going to lose to the Celtics even before Rondo got injured. I thought they were going to come back. Again, this isn't, I'm touting myself, but I'm wrong so much that me being so bullish on the Celtics is making me happy. I don't see how the Wizards hold up to the Cavaliers.
How does Boston hold up to the Cavaliers?
So the Wizards thing with me is if you don't have three or four of your starters playing peak basketball, you have no chance of winning because you can't turn to anyone on the bench. Kelly Oubre Jr., it's pretty cool that he can defend point guards, but his offense is iffy. Whenever they sub out Markieff Morris for Bojan Bogdanovic, the offense is crazy, but the defense is worse than the offense is crazy. You don't really have good reserve bigs right now. You don't know what you're going to get from Jan Mahimi. Brandon Jennings shouldn't be running point for a playoff team. And so and Bradley Beal has not been that great during the postseason. He's, for his career, he's been phenomenal in the playoffs, but he's been so hot and cold this year. And that just puts so much responsibility on John Wall. I want a team, if you're going to go up against the Cavaliers and you have to pull off the upset, I want a team that can beat them in so many different ways. And I think we really saw the potential of the Celtics in that Game 5 win because Isaiah Thomas didn't even do much. The thing he did most was being Isaiah Thomas in the sense that the mere threat of him really just warped some of Washington's defensive sets and it created opportunities for others. When he kicks out, it's almost either always to an open shooter or the guy who's catching the pass can find a third person who's wide open because no one can rotate fast enough, and he instills such fear on those collapses. But Al Horford, to me, he's the Celtics' best two-way player during the postseason. I would listen to arguments that he's been better than Isaiah Thomas for the playoffs.
I think I would say he probably has been. But
right,
keep
and
going.
The perception of him is warped because, and that's the second time I use warped in 3 seconds, but the optics aren't good because of those quote-unquote bad two games he had against Robin Lopez. I was writing about this a week ago or something. During that Bulls series, Al Horford averaged 11.8 points, 4.5 assists, shot 70% overall, and 75% from the three-point line when Robin Lopez was on the floor. So Horford didn't get owned by Robin Lopez.
Yeah.
There's just this misconception around him, and he can defend either Kevin Love or Tristan Thompson. You can keep him on the floor against team small ball lineups, and if he's your center, you have a five-out lineup without necessarily sacrificing rim protection. He's not the best rim protector, but it's different than if the Cavs have Tristan Thompson at the five. His best floor spacing ability comes from his screens. Horford sets screens. He'll catch you off guard with his passes, and he shoots threes. And the fact that the Celtics are so much deeper, the fact that they can throw so many different defensive looks at LeBron, no, they're not going to slow him. But I could see a series in which LeBron is the only Cavalier that's having a good best of seven set because they have the personnel, it seems, to neutralize Kevin Love. They can make life hell on Kyrie Irving. I think in most lineups that the Cavs will run out, there will be someone that Isaiah Thomas can be stashed on, whether it's Shumpert or J.R. Smith or Kyle Korver or whomever that is just a glorified spot-up shooter at this point. You can probably get away with having him on the floor. And if you can't, Marcus Smart can defend power forwards. Is a point guard who defends power forwards, and it's not a mismatch. I saw someone talking about this on Twitter the other night, and I remember thinking about this, and I might have written about it once. He defends, like, up three positions, two or three positions, and it's never a mismatch.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
So I just look at that depth and then how vulnerable Washington is when things don't go according to plan. They just don't have the personnel to adjust. And I kind of agree that they're more top-heavy, which I guess could be argued is better. John Wall, is the best player in the Boston Washington series, like overall, just looking in the scheme of the NBA hierarchy. But against the Cavaliers, I'm going to value depth and versatility and what the Celtics do more than what the Wizards do. And that's my diatribe on why Boston, even though they'll probably lose in five, is the better, the bigger threat to Cleveland.
I'm going to throw some Horford stats out.
I'm going to catch him. I'm going to motorboat him.
I was looking this up as you were talking. His playoff box plus minus is 8.2. And then just for a reference point, Isaiah Thomas's is 1.3.
What's Isaiah's breakdown offensive box plus minus?
So Isaiah's offensive is 3.5, which is way lower than it was in the regular season. And it's minus 2.2 defensive, which is probably actually better than it was in the regular season. but keep continuing with Horford, 24.8 PER. This is the one that's really crazy. Actually, there's a couple that are crazy. His true shooting percentage in the playoffs is 732 in 11 games. That's insane. His assist percentage leads the Celtics 29.6. His just basic numbers, 15.8 points, 7.7 rebounds, 6.1 assists, 64% from the field, 57% from three. He's been unbelievable.
It's absolute. And
if there was any questions about that contract being worth it, I would hope they've been answered by now.
I tweeted this during the Bulls series, and I retweeted it again the other night. So I retweeted myself because I'm vain. I said, imagine ever thinking that the Celtics shouldn't have paid Al Horford. The argument is just, it's so flimsy. It's honestly, and I try to respect people that at least sometimes appear like they're trying to have these rational discussions, but that opinion is such crap. Like, it's just, it's lazy, it's wrong. The market for Al Horford was a max contract. And this isn't a situation where you can say, well, there was so much money, Alan Crabb got so much of it, Chandler Parsons got a max deal. Okay, if Al Horford entered the market this summer, he would still get a max contract. Alan Crabb wouldn't get as much money. Chandler Parsons wouldn't get a max contract. Al Horford is fantastic. And people who don't realize it because he's not averaging 20 points a game.
I was just going to say it comes down to points. I think there's still a huge contingent of NBA fans that just analyze a player based on how much he scores.
They're idiots.
And there's obviously so much more that goes there's so much more that goes into basketball. Imagine having a center who can average six assists a game. Think about all the different possibilities that can open.
And that's the thing. Which name a big man in the league right now who can impact the game in more ways than him?
Yeah, that's tough to come up with.
Is it maybe it's Anthony Davis or DeMarcus Cousins, but I don't know if Cousins has.
But neither one of them is the I was going to say neither one of them is the creator and passer that Horford is. Maybe Cousins, but
is he the defender that Horford is? Like, he's not going to switch the way Horford. It's just again, and there are better big men, and Anthony Davis and DeMarcus Cousins are two of them. But I don't know that there's a big man in the game right now who can impact a game or the outcome of a game or a series in more ways than Al Horford.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. So Boston's up 3-2 in that series. We haven't talked a lot about that series specifically, but seems like they're probably going to win, right?
Yeah, I don't know if it'll be game six that they'll win. I could see them winning it. They're going to win this series. I picked them in seven. I wouldn't be surprised to see them close it out in game six. Again, everything that I said about the Wizards as it pertains to the Cavs just applies to Boston. They're not going to have everyone firing on all cylinders every night, and when they don't, they can't win. Whereas Boston, think about the first four games of that series. Boston wasn't good. Like, you had Isaiah Thomas exploding at points, but the Celtics objectively weren't good, and the series was still tied 2-2.
Yeah, but I still think that, and I think you'd probably agree, like, Even if either one of those teams is firing on all cylinders, I still don't think they can win more than like a game or two from Cleveland.
I don't think either of them will be more competitive against Cleveland this season than the Raptors were last year. Even though I think you could argue that both these teams right now are better than that Raptors squad, you just look at the way LeBron and the Cavs are playing. If that series goes to six games, I don't care how superficial the length would be. That would be like a major accomplishment for Washington or Boston.
I agree. I honestly think both Golden State and Cleveland should be 12-0 by the time the finals start.
I wouldn't be surprised for Cleveland, but I honestly would be kind of shocked if the Spurs don't even get a game. And maybe I'm underestimating the Warriors, but like.
Well, I should say, like, I use the word should carefully. Like, I don't necessarily think that that is what will happen, but I think it should be what I mean. I feel like the talent gap is so extreme, but I do. Like you said, it would be surprising if there wasn't at least one letdown at some point along the way.
Right. So I totally understand that. And this kind of brings about a larger question, because you're saying they should be 12-0 by the time they get to the NBA Finals. And you can say that whether or not people think you're right, there's an argument to be made that you are right. This isn't like an unfounded claim. What do you do if you're the rest of the league at this point? We're looking at a lot of teams that are entering a crossroads this summer. You have the Jazz. Yes, you can't let Gordon Hayward walk for nothing, but what's the incentive of going so far into the luxury tax to keep Joe Ingles and George Hill and this core intact when you know it's not going to beat the Warriors? For the Raptors, we know they're not going to bring everyone back because their payroll would soar past $150 million. But what, do you pay Kyle Lowry and Max Steele? Yes, you don't want to lose him for nothing, but do you bring back most of these guys? Do you commit $130 million to a roster that isn't going to compete with the Cavaliers? The Celtics, you know, they can balance rebuilding with competing, but everyone wants them to trade for Jimmy Butler or Paul George. If they get slaughtered by the Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference Finals, or if they don't even get to the Eastern Conference Finals, isn't there an appeal in keeping these Nets picks, developing them, and hoping that you're ready to go once Cleveland's window is closed? Like, we're at this stage where, okay, fine, the Spurs, they can keep doing what they're doing because no matter what they do, they're going to churn out 50-plus victories and be a faux contender, and people will talk about them. But all these other teams, what is the incentive to really go for it? I understand that there are certain squads and markets that cannot bottom out because they will lose the fan base. And I understand that you can't just blow things up. The Clippers aren't going to blow it up by their own hand. If they don't look the same next year, it's because Chris Paul and Blake Griffin, one or both, decided to leave, not because the Clippers decided not to bring them back. But how do you go all in, I guess is my question, when this is the landscape right now where almost the NBA Finals participants can be determined by two questions. Are you a fan of the Warriors? No. Oh, your team's not in the NBA Finals. Do you have LeBron? No, your team's not in the NBA Finals.
So to me, it comes down to how does a team define success in this era?
I feel like this is about to get profound. I'm excited.
That's probably – I just went about as deep as this is going to go, so sorry to let you down. Does your fan base or does your organization – is winning a title the only thing that you would consider success? And I think a lot of fans are that way. Every season that doesn't end with a championship is a failure, and you want to think of ways to make your team a real championship contender over the summer. But I think there's another way to look at it. Maybe success is a 50-win team that can get to the second round of the playoffs and hope for an injury. I mean, a 50-win team, generally you have pretty good attendance. You get the gate receipts for at least a round of the playoffs.
Right.
I mean, there's economic success to be found there. There's also economic risks, which you laid out, going deep into the luxury tax for a team that maybe doesn't get past more than one or two rounds in the playoffs. So it's an interesting trade-off, but I think to say that the only thing that you would consider actual success winning a title, especially in this era where the Warriors and the Cavs do exist, is a little short-sighted. So I think if everybody was sort of on that bandwagon and everybody was trying to bottom out and rebuild and have a good team by the time the Warriors and the Cavs windows are closed, then that makes it even easier for the Warriors and the Cavs to continue to play each other year after year after year. So I think we will have teams, and I think we will need teams that are still going to try, hopeless as it may seem, to put together teams that can beat these squads. I think Boston is an interesting one because, like you said, they can go either way right now. For them, I would agree with you. I think you were leaning towards keep those assets, develop those young guys, and be ready when Cleveland's title window closes, because I think that one may be closing a little earlier than the Warriors. I said this before we started recording. LeBron's durability, it's just insane for him to be able to do what he's done for as long as he's done it and to still look like he's not slowing down at all. But he is in his 30s and he does have a ton of mileage on his legs. So eventually it has to stop at some point, I would think, unless he really is some kind of a robot. For Toronto, I mean, these are tough questions for Toronto and Utah. I think Toronto, maybe I would lean the same way with Boston, because maybe Cleveland's window closes earlier than Golden State's. Utah, you just sold the fan base on a rebuild 3 or 4 years ago. Do you really want to try and sell them on that again? There's just so many things to consider in all of this. I think my general, like, overarching point is, though, that you cannot analyze your team or your season as success or failure based on one thing, and that's winning a title. I don't know if that long-winded explanation makes sense, but that's kind of how I'm looking at it.
No, I totally agree with pretty much everything you said, and I would advocate for the Celtics now. I didn't want them to do anything at the trade deadline because midseason additions to me weren't going to help them get past the Cavaliers. You would still be tethered to LeBron maybe getting injured or something happening to the Cavs. You could probably argue that Cleveland's window is shorter than the Warriors. And I don't mean probably, it is. LeBron James is LeBron James, but the Warriors are still going to be here, probably playing close to at this level if they keep the core intact in 5 years. The Cavaliers won't. LeBron will be older. So that's the incentive if you're the Celtics or another team in the East to go for it. And I do agree that it's short-sighted to evaluate everything in the context of can we beat these two teams. At the same time, I think you get to a point where that has to be the benchmark. And I'm looking at...
Or at least, like, factors in. Right, I would agree with that.
Like, if you're looking at the Jazz, the Raptors, the Clippers, those payroll situations, I think you need to factor in, can we beat these teams? And if we can't, can we continue to churn out these 50-win seasons or these faux competitive seasons and pivot if we want to? And that might be the bigger thing, is if you sign these contracts, if the Raptors pay near max for Ibaka because maybe they know Miami's going to overpay him, and if you give Kyle Lowry the max, do you know that if you decide after next year or during next year that you don't want to do this anymore, that it's pointless, can you pivot and trade these guys and have that path to starting over?
So I think that would be easier for Utah because the guys they're going to, with the exception of George Hill, Gordon Hayward will be more tradable than Kyle Lowry, I think, but keep going.
No, and I'm not saying they won't be able to pivot. It'll get iffy for the Jazz with how much are they going to have to pay to keep Joe Ingles. Objectively speaking, I know the cap landscape is going to be a little bit different, but I initially thought that he was going to get like $12 or $13 million a year, but the Raptors gave Damari Carroll 4 years and $60 million. And Joe Ingles is objectively better.
Definitely better. Yeah.
So
that one is a little bit nerve wracking.
Right. So that if they bring him back, I'm just saying that contract could be tough to move. The George Hill contract will be tough to move, either if it's a max or close to a max, or if it's a 5-year deal. It better not be a 5-year deal, by the way. The Gordon Hayward, out of all these players, and that includes Griffin and Paul, he'll be the easiest to move, because even if you think that Paul at that point will still be better, good luck trying to like cobble together the assets that match his $35 million salary.
Yeah. And Hayward is only 26 years old.
Right. And so that's why he's going to be
part of that.
So it's easier for the Jazz to go for it And also, they have the justification of going there in a small market. They have a loyal fan base. Not that Jazz fans will be content, but they're not going to get sick of winning 50 games and contending for home court advantage in the first round. Toronto and Los Angeles are interesting, and Boston's just super interesting because they're kind of caught in the middle and they have more options than any other team. But the Raptors and the Clippers are at that point where you have to say, if we can't compete with these teams, we can't lose these assets for nothing, but can we sign them to deals that pigeonhole us to this fate or worse for the next 4 to 5 years? And that's just the interesting question for me. And the NBA's upper middle class is really going to have to reconcile a few things this summer. And there'll be multiple teams that do it. Even the Rockets, you know, their cap situation isn't bad, but they're not going to have a ton of money. You have James Harden, who's probably still young enough to headline a rebuild if he wanted to. But do you commit to this model of trying to beat the Warriors by being the Warriors? It's just so many things have to be evaluated when that is your goal and you've reached the apex of your development where you have to say, this is the goal. Can we do this? Can we beat these teams? Can we actually contend with them? And again, just especially the Raptors and the Clippers, because now they're actually at a stage where they have to reinvest a lot of money in these models. So I'm just very interested to see what happens. And I'm always of the mind, this is why the blow up the Clippers takes have always been short-sighted to me. I'm of the mind, you re-sign your top assets, you figure out the rest later, because you can't afford to lose these guys for nothing. And Atlanta might be a great case here, because they're not a threat to Cleveland, and they lost Al Horford for nothing. That was dumb. And if Paul Millsap leaves and you didn't capitalize off his departure, how far have you set yourself back now to where you're not, you can't even be spun as, you know, fake competitive, as a pretender, because you've lost these assets without capitalizing on their exit. So there's just so many interesting situations this summer. And I think, as much as some people might think the Warriors-Cavaliers rivalry is boring, let's say it is, the trickle-down effects that this rivalry will have, or this collective dominance will have on the rest of the league, is just fascinating to me.
Yeah, it really is. What I was thinking when you were talking is, if you do sink, I mean, tons of money, go into the luxury tax, let's say for the Clippers and Toronto, you bring everybody back. Toronto probably can at least try to trade Valanciunas, but even then, they'll be in the luxury tax.
Can I interject with a hot take?
Go ahead.
They need to trade DeMar DeRozan. Go on.
you don't have to sell me on that. You might have to sell some Raptors fans, but anyway, what I was thinking is, let's say you do recommit to the current path you're already on. You're deep in the luxury tax, and you just get waxed again next year. But now you have all these same guys on, instead of expiring deals, 3 or 4 years left on their deal. Then I think your whole discussion about pivoting it's kind of difficult to do. Then you just kind of have to wait for 2 or 3 years before those contracts become tradable again. I think there is some risk inherent to that strategy as well. Like, who's gonna trade for 30? How old is Chris Paul now? Like 32, 33?
31.
Let me look. Who's gonna give up the farm for a 31-year-old point guard that has like 4 years and $100 million left?
32. Forgot his birthday was on May 6th.
Which is actually, that's actually younger than I thought. But I don't know, like, these contracts might be kind of hard to move in the first year or two that they're on the books, is all I'm saying.
I totally agree with you. It's just so fascinating to me. And you know what makes it more difficult is the players themselves. How do you justify, let's use the Clippers and the Raptors as an example, because Utah's just a little bit different, even though this is something they definitely have to worry about. If your players are willing to come back because they can't go anywhere else, that's an upgrade, why would you not bring them back? But the example would be Chris Paul and the Spurs. I don't think people realize how many hoops San Antonio has to jump through to sign Chris Paul. And I was reading, I think this was on FanRag the other day, someone wrote that one of the paths that the Spurs could explore to getting Chris Paul is waiving and stretching Tony Parker, trading Danny Green, and trading LaMarcus Aldridge. No.
Yeah, that's a lot.
So it's just like, And I get it. That's what the Spurs have to do, especially if Paul's not willing to accept a pay cut. So from the Spurs standpoint, Lowry is probably more likely to accept less than the max, just because Chris Paul, who runs the Players Association, basically, didn't he champion getting rid of the over 36 rule so that he could technically sign the deal?
Yeah, he's like, they're calling it the Chris Paul extension already.
Yeah, so why would he pass on that? But again, like, where is he going to go that's a better situation? You could honestly argue that the smarter play would be for him or Kyle Lowry to go to a team like Denver, because then you automatically turn them into probably a 5 seed in the West.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, you have these younger guys around you who, if they hit, all of a sudden you're relevant into your twilight, and maybe you've caught on to a team that won't have to deal with prime LeBron James or prime Stephen Curry. Like, those options are just so bizarre. Well, why would you leave the Clippers? Because there's not necessarily a better situation, unless Pau Gasol opts out of his contract in San Antonio and the path to cap space is clearer. That's not going to happen. It's just, there's so many different layers to it. But I do think that the Warriors and the Cavaliers are a part of all of it. And if you see Chris Paul, I know NBA players are inherently confident, but if you see Chris Paul specifically go back to the Clippers, he has to do that, kind of just knowing I'm not going to win a title.
Yeah. I was going to say, it made me think of, I think most NBA players are really confident, but after you've been sort of beaten down by the Warriors as many times as most of these guys have, at some point, reality sets in. I agree with you there. I was thinking when I played for a Division III school, and we were really good for a Division III team. We had guys who had been kicked out of Division I and Division II schools. We had guys who'd had offers from bigger schools. We all just kind of ended up on this tiny little school for a bunch of random reasons. That school will never approach that level of talent again. It was like a perfect confluence of events. And we played a couple of Division I teams, and we were really confident. We thought we could beat these teams. And I remember specifically playing Liberty one year that they went to the NCAA tournament. And there was a moment of realization, like halfway through the game maybe, they're just bigger, faster, and more athletic at every single position. And it was like we entered with so much confidence, and it didn't take long before you realized this team is just better than us. And I think that has to happen with NBA players at some point, unless maybe you're Dion Waiters. But there has to be some acknowledgement at some point that we're not getting past this Warriors team as currently constructed, unless like something crazy happens. Two injuries, maybe. I don't know.
I guess this would be kind of a tangent, but do you know what an interesting offshoot of this Warriors-Cavaliers landscape is going to be? Is it going to force not just writers, but fans to be more nuanced about how they evaluate careers and legacies, where you have to rise above the ring count or postseason success?
I think it should.
Because
already kind of, I don't know who wrote this, but I don't even remember what platform. Maybe it was Bleacher Report. But there was some article about all the players that had basically been denied rings because they played in Jordan's era. And now the same thing is kind of happening again. There are just tons of great players who are probably never going to win a championship because they just happen to be in the NBA at the same time as this two-horse race that is the Warriors and the Cavs.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. You can't fault people for running into Michael Jordan. You can't fault them to running into perhaps the greatest team ever assembled in the Warriors. You can't fault them for running into the best player to ever play the game in LeBron James. It's just that, so that might be, again, and this stuff, I think, in the context, all matters. It's not boring. You know, even if this becomes an affair where we're going to talk about two or three more Warriors-Cavs finals matchups, think about all the trickle-down effects. And if teams aren't competing, I'm interested to see how everyone else responds. But there's always going to be someone who's trying to beat the Warriors or be the next great team. So I want to see them try and do that. And if there are teams that are going to tear it down and rebuild and take the Sam Hinkie route, I want to see that too. I just want to see what the response is. And again, it's going to be super interesting. I don't think it's boring by any means, but there is so, now that I've come full circle and keep saying the same thing over and over again, there's just so much here to unpack.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that's probably a good place to wrap. We'll have a lot to unpack over the course of the offseason. As the draft happens in free agency, I think we'll obviously get a much clearer picture about how these teams are going to proceed. If you're a fan of any NBA team and you know, want to talk to us about how your team will proceed, hit us up on Twitter. I'm at Andrew D. Bailey. Dan is at Dan Favale, F-A-V-A-L-E. The show is at Hardwood Knox. As always, we would really appreciate a subscription, a like, a review, any of that stuff on Apple Podcasts or Blog Talk Radio or Stitcher. Give us 5 stars, whatever you want to do. We will be back. And until then, we leave you with a shout out to Bino. You want to finish it, Dan? Bino Udrih.
Shout out to Dejounte Murray.
I knew you weren't going to shout out Bino.
More conference finals appearances than Chris Paul.
And it's going to keep going up for Dejounte.